Previously on The Storyteller, Naked Villainy. A tense morning in court as the legal direction ends and the deliberation begins.
Will you now please retire to consider your verdict?
Last minute nerves.
I woke up this morning and I thought, I curse that not proven verdict in Scotland, just in case that's used as a cop-out.
And a 45-year road to justice comes to an end with one word.
What is your verdict in respect of the accused, Christopher Merlin Harnett Harrison, of charge 4 on the indictment?
Guilty.
It's taken 45 years to bring a killer to court. And for the first time in UK history, you'll hear the full murder trial and witness justice being done. It was a brutal murder of a brilliant woman who was a rising star in genetic research.
It would now be almost like a script from Morse. The investigators swarming over the dreaming spires of university land.
There was kind of palpable feeling of evil in the air.
I was told it was just a mass of blood and hair.
2 decades on from confronting evil.
Did you kill your ex-wife, Brenda Page?
Evil is being confronted by the law.
Did you kill her?
No.
She knew it was coming.
He said he was going to kill her.
If he killed her, he would do it so that nobody would know.
Will his true nature be unmasked?
Are you familiar with the tale of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde?
And can Brenda's own words help secure her killer's fate?
A letter of a death foretold.
This is The Storyteller, Naked Villainy, written, produced and edited by me, Isla Traquair. The word guilty cut through the tense air like a guillotine, as though all our energy had been suspended in space and then gravity suddenly hit. But before the crowd could cheer, the tears could fall, the exhale fully let out, our breaths were held again because the trial was not yet over. There was more discussion, more painful pauses, and for the first time, handcuffs to be put on the tall but stooped man in the dock. We'll rejoin at the moment immediately after the verdict was noted.
Thank you, my lord. My lord, I move for sentence against Christopher Merlin Harnett Harrison. There is no schedule to lay before the court. My lord, so far as the procedural history is concerned, Dr. Harrison appeared on petition on the 18th of March 2020 when he was admitted to bail, subject to standard conditions, along with a condition which he surrender his passport, with which he complied. The case was then prepared, but unfortunately the pandemic interfered with the progress of the case, and although the case was marked to proceed in July of 2021, it was subsequently indicted for a preliminary hearing on the 11th of February 2022, and on that occasion a trial was fixed for the 22nd of August last year. There were a number of lines of inquiry which were quite properly advanced by those then representing Dr. Harrison, particularly in relation to the biology involved in the case. The case called before his lordship in that sitting of the High Court here in Aberdeen in August, and after several days it was obvious that there were some trouble between those advising Dr. Harrison at the time, with the result that his legal team withdrew from acting, and that resulted in a fresh diet of trial being fixed, which is the present proceedings. His Lordship has heard much in the evidence regarding the personal circumstances of Dr. Harrison. There's nothing I seek to add to that. I have tendered for His Lordship's consideration a victim statement form on behalf of Rita Ling, but also the entire family. And it is obvious from that document that the sense of loss which that family has endured for some 45 years. His Lordship heard something of the work of Dr. Page. It is again obvious that she was a highly talented individual who at 32 was in a very senior position with the university, undertaking groundbreaking and important work, particularly in relation to human reproduction biology, work which was continued by colleagues, but it's clear she laid a very significant foundation for that important work. Those are the submissions I wish to make today, my Lord.
Thank you, Mr. Deputy. Mr. McConachie.
Lord, obviously, having regards to the verdict of the ladies and gentlemen of the jury, there's nothing I have to say in respect of the circumstances of the offence of which the ladies and gentlemen have found the accused guilty. Your Lordship heard something of the personal circumstances so far as Dr. Harrison is concerned. He is now 82 years of age. With the exception of the crime the ladies and gentlemen have now convicted him of, he has never been before the court for any matter previously. He has been in a relationship with his partner now since 1979. She has had recent health concerns which have involved two cardiac arrests in recent times. Dr. Harrison worked until his retirement in 2005. So far as he is concerned, he is on medication for hypertension. He is also awaiting an operation for an enlarged prostate. As your Lordship is, of course, aware, although the ladies and gentlemen may not be, the only sentence which is available to your Lordship for an offence of this nature is one of life imprisonment. Albeit your Lordship has to impose a punishment part in respect of Dr. Harrison. I don't think it's particularly controversial to say that in the circumstances of this case, given Dr. Harrison's age, the sentence of life imprisonment is likely to be one which does not extend in the sense that there is every likelihood he will die in custody. Clearly, somebody with the background of Dr. Harrison will find imprisonment extremely difficult to deal with. Although he has never been in custody before, in view of the fact there is no alternative sentence, I don't think justifiably there's anything I could suggest would be gained by obtaining a criminal justice social work report in the circumstances of this case. It's really perhaps Dr. Harrison's age is the primary mitigatory factor in relation to the length of the punishment part which your Lordship might impose.
Christopher Harrison, you may remain seated for the moment. You have been found guilty of the murder of your former wife, Dr. Brenda Page, on the 14th of July, 1978. On the evidence which I have heard, your actions that night appear to have been premeditated, at least to a degree. It appears that you were stalking Brenda Page that night. You then forced entry to her flat by prising open a rear window while she was out and waited for her to return. You then subjected her to a sustained and vicious attack. You struck her at least 20 times on the face and head with a blunt weapon. You continued to hit her even as she sought to protect her face and head with her hands and arms. Your assault caused her skull to be fractured and significant intracranial bleeding. Brenda Page lost consciousness and died while in a state of coma from inhalation of blood. As a result of your senseless act of violence, you brought the life of Dr. Brenda Page to a brutal and premature end. You created a void in the lives of her mother, her sister, her nephews, and her friends, which could never be filled. Her potential as a brilliant scientist was left forever unrealized. In that regard, I have read the deeply moving statement prepared by her sister. It is clear to me that even now, almost 45 years later, the effect of your actions on the 14th of July, 1978, continue to be felt. The sentence for murder is fixed by law, and shortly I will impose that sentence on you. At the same time, I must fix the punishment part for your sentence, being the period you must spend in full in prison before you can apply to the parole board for Scotland to be released on licence. The punishment part must satisfy the requirements for retribution and deterrence, taking account of the seriousness of the murder, but ignoring any period of confinement which may be necessary for the protection of the public. You are 82 years of age. I note that you appear before me as a first offender with no prior criminal history. I have also taken into account everything that's been said on your behalf by Mr. McConaghy. From your position at trial, I understand that you continue to deny responsibility for your actions and you show no remorse. Stand up, please. Christopher Harrison, having taken account of the whole circumstances of your case, I sentence you to life imprisonment and impose a punishment part of 20 years. That will run from today's date. That is all.
Pop your hand up like that for me.
That was the sound of a handcuff being put on Dr. Kit Harrison. He was politely asked to put his hand up so the cuff could be put on, attaching him to the officer of the court. He hesitated and looked back at his briefcase and hat sitting on the cushioned seat of the dock beyond him, as though to check if he should take them with him. Someone else would deal with them. There'd be no need for a briefcase in prison, nor would he be allowed. His uniform of a life in academia of tweed, cashmere and wool would be exchanged for something far less luxurious on the skin and prison issued. There was no reaction from him. He was led out while we remained in the court. It was as though he was being taken through to a consultation with a doctor, except he was physically attached to his police escort by handcuffs. How odd it must have felt for the officer to touch the thin skin of such an elderly man, fragile bones of his wrist taking the weight of the metal cuff. The judge still had the final word to say.
Ladies and gentlemen, the last thing it remains for me to do is to thank you for your attendance, for your attention and for your patience. Service on a jury is one of the most onerous duties which our state requires of its citizens. I hope that during the course of your service, you have gained some insight into our system of justice and come to appreciate that it is only through the dedication and energy of people such as yourselves that it can continue to function. So, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to invite you to withdraw for the last time, but I do so with the sincere gratitude of the court. Thank you very much.
The 15 strangers bonded through this experience, unlikely to meet again, and instructed to never discuss the case or what was said in the jury room, leave the court to return to their lives, forever changed.
More.
And then it was over. The tidal wave could start coming out as we descended the stairs. Whispers of our feelings.
I actually had tears come in my eyes.
And once outside the building, the air hitting me, and asked a simple question of how I was feeling, 20 years of being connected to an outrageous injustice spilled out.
I choked up. I couldn't help it. I had tears come in my eyes because it's just, you know... Oh, God. I just feel for her family. It's been 45 years and... Oh. You know, can't believe it's actually happened. We just didn't think we would ever get to this stage. And we were all panicking a bit because they were taking so long. And then finally they came back and... Guilty. I'd expected unanimous majority. No one cares. It's guilty. But also this mixed emotion of, you know, this is an evil man who committed the most awful crime against the most incredible woman. But you cannot help but view him through the lens of he's 82 and he's old and he's like this. And, you know, seeing him standing up and getting handcuffs on him, you can't help but like associate like, to someone else's, your grandfather or something, and it feels weird because there's this, you know, he does deserve to rot in prison, he does deserve to die in prison, but you can't help, because of his age, look at him and go, oh, but no, I do want him to spend the rest of his life in prison, and he deserved to spend a hell of a lot more of it in prison. He's had 45 years free, they've had 45 years without Brenda, and, it's far too late, but you know, thank God it's happened finally, and I wish I could give Rita a hug right now. You know, obviously what journalists, nothing compared to what families go through, nothing, but, you know, I feel attached to her from 20 years ago. I should be a professional journalist, but this is a big deal. It's a big deal for women. To show the difference between the times when the term coercive control just didn't exist. It's been used heavily by the police and used throughout this court case. Domestic violence, stalking. She was a victim of all these things. It could have been prevented. It was murder in slow motion and it happened and she knew it was going to happen and she told everyone it was going to happen. It did happen. And even though she told everyone, it's taken 45 years for them to find justice. But... I'm relieved. I need a moment to calm down. But yeah, oof. I don't think I've ever bubbled like... I've never bubbled like this after a court case. A bit embarrassed, actually.
I said more, but it's more important to hear from Brenda's nephew, Christopher Ling, and what he said to the press on the steps of the High Court in Aberdeen. The winter sun was shining on him, as he held the paper with the statement in his hands and bravely faced the cameras, having had barely a moment to absorb what had just happened.
But not a day goes by when we don't think about Brenda and the horrendous ordeal she must have suffered that night. Brenda was an extremely kind, intelligent woman with her whole life ahead of her. It hurts us to think of the great things she would have undoubtedly achieved. 45 years is a long time to be at liberty, whilst the family have endured such tragedy, sadness and loss. Reliving these events over and over again, each time Brenda's case was reinvestigated or publicised in the media, was difficult to say the least. It is a great sadness that some of our family and friends are no longer with us to see this day, but we are delighted that my mum, Brenda's sister, has finally seen Christopher Harrison found guilty of the brutal crime she always knew he committed.
The man who led the reinvestigation was Detective Inspector Gary Winter of Police Scotland's Major Investigation Team. He held a briefing for the press a few days before the verdict on the condition we wait until after the case concluded. It was the first time the police were able to be more open about what they knew. He began by reading a statement.
So Brenda Page was studying Glasgow University when she met Christopher Harrison and the pair married in 1972. Inquiries revealed that Brenda was domestically abused from the beginning of the relationship and was hospitalised on more than one occasion following assaults to her head. Brenda moved to the northeast of Scotland in October 1973 after securing employment as the principal of the genetics department of Aberdeen University. Christopher Harrison later joined her in Aberdeen and secured a researcher's post at the university. They brought a house together at Mile End Place, where Harrison still lives. Harrison continued to abuse and assault Brenda, culminating in her being told to leave the marital home. In correspondence to her solicitor at the time, she details a catalogue of violent assaults every few months and threats from Harrison to kill her. Evidence led in court heard how she wrote, "If I depart this earth rather suddenly, please do make sure I get a good PM, post-mortem, and that my sister and our boys get any benefit." Brenda moved into her final home, a flat at 13 Allen Street in 1976, pursued divorce proceedings followed by repeated assaults, stalking, abusive behaviour and threats. On the 14th of July 1978, after failing to turn up at work, Brenda was discovered dead in her home. A murder inquiry was launched by the then Grampian Police. Later that night, Harrison was apprehended by the police and interviewed about the murder. A report was submitted to the Crown Office and Procurator Fiscal Service at that time. However, they decided there was insufficient evidence to prosecute, and Harrison was released from custody. Postmortem revealed that Brenda had died from multiple serious head injuries. Inquiries continued for years to try to fill evidential gaps. New forensic science techniques were utilised whenever they became available. In February 2015, former Lord Advocate Frank Mulholland instructed Police Scotland to reinvestigate the case. In February 2020, Police Scotland presented the updated circumstantial case to Crown Office, who agreed to proceed with a prosecution. Within weeks of that decision, Harrison was arrested and charged with murder. Bringing the case to court has been a result of more than 8 years' work for Police Scotland's major investigation team, who are based at the Bucksburn Police Office. So, of note in terms of the investigation, how police investigate domestic abuse, domestic homicide has changed significantly. Both police, society in general now have a better understanding of domestic abuse and the full range of behaviours which indicate an abusive relationship, including psychological and emotional behaviours in coercive controlling relationships. The groundbreaking Domestic Abuse Scotland Act 2018 recognises and criminalises coercive and controlling behaviour was based on studies of domestically abusive relationships from the 1970s and 1980s. Harrison was arrested just weeks before the country went into lockdown as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. Following his arrest, officers travelled all over the UK, visiting more than 100 key witnesses to video record their evidence, many of them elderly witnesses who had last spoken to the police more than 40 years ago. They reaffirmed positions and some also provided information not divulged previously, substantially improving available evidence. COVID restrictions meant the inquiry team had to be extra cautious when interviewing vulnerable witnesses whilst adhering to the guidelines, sometimes video recording in garages or back gardens to capture the evidence that would be fit for court. Since 1978, approximately 4,000 people have been spoken to by the police in connection with Brenda's murder. Approximately 3,500 statements have been taken, including more than 500 since the reinvestigation in 2015, and approximately 100 key witnesses were had video recorded evidence captured following his arrest. Paint and DNA from semen have played a key role in the evidence against Harrison. Over the years, forensic science services within the former Grampian Police, the SPA, FSS and Cellmark have all reviewed and examined productions from 1978. This could only have been done thanks to professionalism, thoroughness and integrity of the production seized back in 1970 by the original inquiry team. Police Scotland ensures that time is no barrier to justice. Unsolved and undetected murder cases are never closed in Scotland. The investigation of homicide is an area where the National Police Service has driven high standards of investigation and compassion. The ability to respond professionally and thoroughly and provide answers for families is a core duty of policing. Thank you.
He was asked how important Brenda was in bringing Kit Harrison to court. As I observed early in the trial, it was as though her voice was the loudest, her words being spoken through her friends, colleagues and divorce lawyer in the witness box.
A difficulty with cold cases can be you don't have some of the modern technology that we would have now in terms of domestic relationships and text messages and WhatsApps and all the rest of it, but we do have old-fashioned letters between Brenda and Kit and Brenda and our solicitor and many others, David Kitteridge and others, that allow us to sort of help try and timeline the relationship. And the relationship, as you'll have picked up certainly from court today, is not a straightforward relationship. It's not a relationship whereby it becomes domestically abusive and she leaves them and they never have contact with each other. They do have contact, particularly in 1978 after they're separated and divorced. So the letters, so probably a better understanding of coercive controlling behaviours and why people may react in different ways that you might not think traditionally people would do if they're in an abusive relationship. Understanding that in conjunction with reading our letters and trying to make sense of where they were both at times has helped greatly. That timeline, their relationship and the status it was at the time. So a key part of getting them into court is the motive. You know, if, as I've said there is evidence that he regularly assaults her to the head. If there was no evidence if the evidence supported that they were in a really happy place in 1978, obviously that motive would diminish and it would have been more difficult. What the evidence supports from the letters, in particular some of the ones that were read out today, was she was probably at her most vulnerable position at the time of her murder, was when she finally sent him a letter saying it was over, which we know from studies, bizarrely enough, in the time period of Brenda's murder, that is when the victim is at the greatest risk, when you finally split. So yes, she's divorced. Yes, she's got an interdict, which she hasn't really used to have him apprehended, but it's been there to protect her if she needed it. But in the 1978, she seems to have had a functional relationship with Christopher Harrison for whatever reason. Either to manage his behaviour and limit the risk to herself, or because she had feelings with him and that he'd written her letters and the letters were, "You're the only one that can help me," to try to get her back into his life. That I don't know. But one of the two, she seems to be having a practical relationship with him in 1978. What I mean by that is that period in the immediate lead up to the murder doesn't seem to be abusive. And then she writes him the final letter, she leaves, she's happy, she's down with Rita in Ipswich, and she comes back and she's murdered within days.
The letter most likely planted the seed. Then, as was revealed in a statement read to the court, she told her friend that evening, before she went out, that Kit had attempted to reconcile again, and she made it clear it was over.
From my understanding of looking at the letters and trying to piece together what they were doing at the time, because there is elements of the fact that they do go away to conventions together, you know, which doesn't sit comfortably when I say comfortably, doesn't sit obviously that somebody has had a domestic split but they're still going away together to conventions. There may be a number of reasons for that, and it might be just down to her managing his behaviour by being nice to him, by letting him in the house when she might not want him in the house to prevent her house getting damaged. There's all sorts of potential reasons and explanations for that.
Do you think that the attitudes and the difference in attitudes between the 1970s and now was one of the reasons why it didn't go forward at the time? Because there seems to be most of the evidence that was in court they had then.
Yeah, I would agree.
Is it painful for you sometimes to hear that there is victim, but I mean, I know it's their job, the defence, but victim blaming and language still being used in court?
I don't want to comment too much on what the defence have said, because I'll leave that for the jury to decide, I suppose, who they believe or not believe. But the evidence that I've seen and heard wouldn't support that there was an awful lot of witnesses lying under oath. And it would appear to me that nobody's challenged any witnesses for lying under oath if that's what they thought was happening.
He was asked if there was a key piece of evidence that triggered the arrest.
No, the evidence is as Mr. Prentice said, a culmination of circumstantial evidence. There was you know, a lot of work done forensically to see if the semen and sperm stain could be timed. Because if that is incident specific, then yes, that would have been a significant piece of evidence on its own. Now, most cold cases are solved by forensic evidence. This one, over many scientists looking at it over many years, the conclusion from most was it's absolutely definitely Christopher Harrison's semen sperm sample, but I don't think anyone can say conclusively that it is incident specific. So it adds to it. Additionally, what the forensic evidence adds to, again, as was covered today, is there's nobody else's DNA there. You know, particularly given, you know, what has probably tainted the investigation over a lot of years was the fact that she was involved in escorting. You know, there is no other semen or other DNA on our bed that would support anyone else is involved in our murder. So it literally is a culmination of a lot of the evidence that existed in 1978, better understanding of domestic abusive relationships, where people were at different times, and all the forensic evidence and reworking of the paint samples and paint evidence.
Did that make things more difficult? You're saying it tainted the escort side of things. Did that take the investigation down paths?
I mean, it still taints it because we're speaking about a woman's private life 45 years later that has absolutely nothing to do with her murder.
Did it distract people, though, those investigating?
It was a line of inquiry, obviously, at the time. But I said probably 5 years ago at the 40th anniversary, and it remains the case. There is, you know, the modern interpretation of the word escorting tends to suggest prostitution. Didn't in 1978. There is no evidence of prostitution involved in the inquiry from 4,000 witnesses, 3,500 witness statements. If there was, you would have heard about it for sure. There is not. Brenda was open about her involvement in that with everyone she spoke to, why she was doing it. She was, if you put yourself in her shoes, you've separated from your domestically abusive husband or partner. You're trying to form new relationships. How do you do that when he's turning up at your work, turning up at your home address? How do you go dating with somebody? She told everyone, I used it for dating purposes. That is exactly what she did. There is no evidence to the contrary. And again, in my own particular view, a matter of privacy between her and those others that are involved in that. So she used it. If she met people that she liked over a period of dates, she would date them. That's what she used it for. There was no Match.com, Tinder at that time. It was the best that she could do to try to meet people professionally, engage in conversation, and if she liked them, it was her private choice to see those people. So she deserves as much privacy in death as she had in life.
He was asked if there was any other key suspects at the time.
Well, Harrison was arrested as he arrived back from the Edinburgh trip that night. So, yeah, there was, you know, other people that were looked at and eliminated. But
it always just came back to him, just that the evidence always just pointing back to him.
Is there anything more you can say about that Edinburgh trip? And some of the things that you know about that, I know not all of it's come out in evidence, but is there any more of that timeline that you could give to us?
The timeline that I'll give to you was based on Harrison's evidence, which was elaborate. He claimed he was going back to Edinburgh, thought he was going to be late, drove to Stonehaven rather than drive to Aberdeen railway station, got a train at Stonehaven, returned to Dundee but was going to Edinburgh, went to Edinburgh, went round the university, bought new shoes, replaced the shoes he was wearing with his new shoes. His old shoes have not been found. He returned to Stonehaven, bought another watch strap in Stonehaven, came back to Aberdeen, was arrested as soon as he arrived there, and was told about Brenda's death. You've heard the evidence of that, and then asked to feed his chickens.
Can you say anything about the bag, or what you think he did with it?
The bag's never been found, so when he bought shoes, he took the shoes he was wearing off, put them into a duffel bag, put on the new shoes he'd bought, and the duffel bag is not recovered from his car when he arrives back in Aberdeen when he's arrested.
The bag I'm asking about, Kit mentioned in his evidence, a green Harvard bag. Photographs of a similar bag were shown in the media at the time, as police appealed for anyone who had seen it. One of the theories is he took the bag to the university, where there was an incinerator. The next question was, why had it taken so long for him to be charged?
Process-wise, police arrest, report the circumstances, and Crown Office decide on sufficiency of evidence. And until February 2020, there was no decision from Crown Office that there was a sufficiency of evidence to proceed to trial. So I can't kind of answer that. I don't see circumstances as you do.
I know you've obviously been in touch with some of the retired officers who worked in it at the time, but have you been able to get any sense from them how they feel about the fact that this has finally got to this stage?
Probably like no other case, I think we've found that witnesses are normally quite reluctant for trials, particularly ones that happened a long time ago, because memories aren't the same, and it's a stressful process. But they've all been really, really keen to come and tell their story and give evidence and be heard and let Brenda's story be told.
Because it's a thorn in their side, isn't it, when they've got one, and this has been for many a case that they just hadn't managed to get complete.
Yeah.
Clear would be the word. And how does it feel for you and your team to get to this stage?
Well, we're delighted to get to the stage of our story being heard, and it probably always needed to be tested at trial. You know, you'll have heard arguments from both sides today, and the only real place to test it is at trial. In terms of coercive control, if you Google and look at the power and control wheel from 1980 and or stages of coercive control, you'll see sort of, and parallel that with some of the evidence that you've heard, you'll see that the different stages that a victim goes through, and probably what you learn from it is that often victims will not come forward, will not look for help for quite a long time. They'll try to manage it themselves. They'll maybe limit what they tell family and friends, or they'll take measures to manage their own safety. But at the part where they're at their greatest risk is when they finally split. And the final split, certainly for me looking at it, is not traditionally the divorce or moving out of the house. They still have a relationship. Whether they are trying to get back together in the early 1978 period when they go away to conferences together, or whether she is just managing the risk by being nice to him, I don't know. But that seems to change in June 1978, which was part of the evidence that was went over today. That changes at that point, when she sends him a letter saying that's over. And you then hear evidence from Elsa Christie that within a day or two of her being back in Aberdeen, there's Harrison's threatening to kill her. Again, when you look at the relationship over years, and it is, you know, roller coaster in terms of where they're at different times, given how significant some of the assaults are, you know, you would imagine people would just separate at that point, but probably because he's stalking her and he's ever present, she tries to take some security measures at her house, painting her window shut, things like that, subtle things like that, to keep herself safe from him getting into her house. She manages that to some degree. Is she still managing him when she's been nice to him in the 1978? I don't know. But what's clear is, at his graduation, he invites somebody else over, an ex-girlfriend from America for some unknown reason. And a letter comes from Brenda at that point to say, that's it. Now, whether she's taken the opportunity to use that to finally split from him, or whether she really means that, we will never know. But that is at the point where the coercive control wheel would tell you she is at the greatest risk, and coincidentally is murdered within days.
He was also asked if he knew what the murder weapon was.
Probably a heavy metal object. It could well have been the weapon that was used to prise the window open, something similar to that.
The final question was, having worked on the case for years, what was his lasting impression of Brenda?
A brilliant, likeable, lovable forensic scientist that had a hell of a lot to offer and was involved in some groundbreaking research that she wasn't able to complete. It's a tragedy.
A tragedy sounds like something unavoidable. A natural disaster, an accident. A Shakespearean tragedy, like Romeo and Juliet. But this murder was predicted, forewarned, preventable, and should have been solvable early on. You may recall the late Bill Adams, a retired officer, who hinted at the main players in this story were brilliant scientists, and that was a crucial element in justice being evaded. What he wouldn't say on camera, and an element I've not revealed until now, and can't ever prove, is the theory that Kit Harrison knew the best way to get away with murder was for there to be no bloodied clothes. It was believed by some that he removed his clothes and wore only his shoes. He murdered Brenda while naked, washed away all the blood from his body in her bathroom, before dressing again, looking every bit the presentable academic. And thus I clothe my naked villainy with odd old ends stolen out of Holy Writ, and seem a saint when most I play the devil. This is The Storyteller, Naked Villainy, written, produced, and edited by me, Isla Traquair.